It is now my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker, Candace from Fresno with 8 years. Let's give it up for Candace.
Hi, I'm Candace. I'm definitely an alcoholic. I'm really, really grateful to be here. I want to thank, he's not here, but he'll hear from somebody. Thank Bill H. For asking me to come and share with you guys tonight. I actually just celebrated a birthday. My sobriety date is 10-1-10. And it was a great number. I heard somebody say that. Yeah, that wasn't the number I picked, you know. My favorite number is 3. But I guess if you take the ones out of the date, well, that is 3. So, you know, it's all in God's divine time, and yeah, he picked that date for me. So I'm happy to be here tonight. You know, one thing I wanted to share tonight, first off and foremost, is I want to say thank you to every single person that made the decision tonight and the choice to come here. That's a hard thing to do, especially in the beginning. Sometimes it's even harder to do when you got 8 years, okay? So I just want to say thank you for that. And I'm grateful that you're here to 12-step me as well. I'm going to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and then I'm going to talk to you about how I've been able to stay sober today. What it was like for me, I came from a really loving home, had absolutely no reason to drink, had parents that if there was a law against loving me too much, they would have broke it. And it was really, really nice, you know. I'm very blessed for that. I'm very grateful for that, and I never forget it. But see, what happened was, is even though I had the love of my family, thanks, man. It's like I'm trying to look at all of you, and I can't because there's a big mic. Now I'm good. Now I can see all of your beautiful faces. But yeah, you know, what happened was, is that it wasn't enough. You know, it wasn't enough for me to have loving parents. It wasn't enough for me to have friends and do well in school, you know, when I was little. It got worse as I got older. And what happened was, is the first time I drank alcohol, I remember walking in. I walked into a party. It was like a keg party, okay? But there was more than a keg there. There was like every kind of alcohol you could think of. I'd never seen that much alcohol in my life and had never taken a drop of alcohol. And I walked in that party, and my first thought was, I am going to drink a lot of alcohol tonight. And as I've seen through this program, that's not what normal people say. I thought, I'm going to drink that, and I'm going to drink that. And I did. You know, I proceeded to drink a lot of alcohol that night. And what did I get from my first night of drinking? I completely blacked out, you know. And so that's how it went for me, you know. And I was so sick the next day. And by about 5:30 that next night, I forgot all about how sick I was. I forgot all about how embarrassed I was and things that my friends were telling me I said and did. And all I could think of was, I can't wait to do that again. That was so great. And so I did. And, you know, at 17 years old, the party was on for me. Alcohol was not the first thing I tried, but it was the first thing that really worked. I tried other substances, and they were all right. But alcohol, that took care of everything and made me real calm, made me really funny, I thought, made me real likable again, I thought, and it made me be able to hang out with people and not try so hard, you know. And so I followed that. I followed it for a really, really long time. And I did a couple geographicals, you know. I thought, you know, if I just hang out with different friends, you know, that'll help. That didn't help. The first geographical I did, I had lost my job. I was not employable. I was living back at my parents' house. And so I went to my mom and I told her, you know, I think I have a problem with drugs. And first time I'd ever admitted having a problem with anything. And so she put some plan together, and she got some money together, and she bought me an Amtrak ticket one way to Arkansas to go live with my aunt. Man. And I thought, well, if I can't clean my act up in Arkansas, what can I do, you know? So I got on that train, and that train, and there was some bus travel involved in that, and it took about 7.5 days to get there, okay? Man, for about the first 4 days I slept, but then once I woke up, well, the party was on. I was on an Amtrak. I was meeting people I'd never met before. This is great, you know? And they're bringing alcohol on the train, and they got other substances, you know? But I went after the alcohol, and I had a really good time, you know? And what happened was I did manage to sober up when I got off the train, and my aunt was there waiting for me, and I got in her car, and I remember I shut the door, and I looked down, I'm like, what's that? And she's like, oh, it's my drink. They got drive-through bars here, drive-through liquor stores. I said, oh, my gosh. I don't think I moved in with the right aunt. So what ended up happening for me is I was a beginning, you know, from the first time I drank, I had absolutely no control over how much I drank. And there was no stopping me once I started. Okay, I don't know if any of you in this room can relate. But once I started, I couldn't stop. But I was able, at that point, before I went to Arkansas, you know, I was able to kind of put it down a little bit. I mean, I'd pick it back up. I'm not saying, I mean, it was 3 days. But I mean, it was 3 days. And then I would pick back up that drink. But when I got to Arkansas, I learned a whole new level of my alcoholism. And I learned that for me, I was an alcoholic who liked to sing karaoke. And I sang karaoke. And I won contests and stuff. It was cool. And then I got a job. And then I got fired. And the whole job was I worked for a beer joint. Of course. And so all I had to do was literally crack open the beer and hand it to him. You know, a can of beer. Okay. It was just a beer joint. They didn't sell anything else. And I got fired from that. That's pretty bad. That's all I had to do was just, but anyways. I was not trustworthy. They couldn't depend on me. I showed up late. They thought I stole from the till. To this day, I can't tell you whether I did or not. I was always in a blackout or a drunk. And so Arkansas, my first geographical, that didn't work for me, you know. I had to do a lot of things to really get to the point where I was able to go, yeah, I think I have a problem that's a little bit bigger than me. So I moved back to Clovis, and after that, we ended up moving to Reno, Nevada. And I thought, okay, this time things are going to be different, you know. And I got a pretty good job, and got a job doing something I really liked. It was helping people with medical equipment, you know, chairs, lifts for their car, stuff like that. And I did really well, you know, but it only took me a matter of time, maybe like a couple of weeks, and I found out who the people were that drank like me that worked there. And then we hung out. And after a while, I didn't have that job anymore. I was asked to leave from that one. So you're seeing a pattern. And so what it was like for me was that it became to a point where, and in there I was married, and I divorced him because he didn't like my drinking. He thought I drank too much, and he said, you don't need to go out to bars and stuff, you know, just stay home. And I said, yeah, that's not going to happen, so you're not going to be around anymore. And so then I took care of that. And you know, what I started to see was that that drinking was really helping me at that time, and now I see, looking back, it was my solution, okay? And it was doing the job for me that I just couldn't live life without it. And so anybody or anything, including an employer, a man, a friend. I dropped lots of friends because they got mad because I got them 86th out of bars. I'm like, that's the fun part. You know, they didn't understand that, you know. And anybody who didn't understand my drinking or gave me any kind of problem about it, I just, you're gone, you know. And I just divorced myself from them. Sorry, the pun. And so that's really where it came to for me. While living in Nevada, because I couldn't hold a job and because no one would let me stay with them anymore because I had burned all my bridges, I was back at my mom's, and she ended up deciding to go to Arkansas to go see the family that I had screwed over a couple years before. And she was going to go see them because a lot of them were getting older, and she was afraid they weren't going to make it, and so she wanted to go visit. She was gone probably about 10 days, and before she left, she looked at me very square in the eyes, and as much as I could, best I could do to see her and try to concentrate like I wasn't messed up and tanked. And I do remember her saying to me, I'm going on this trip. If you steal from me, you're out of here. Don't steal from me. You don't do that. You don't steal from your family. I said, I can't even believe you would say that to me. I was shocked and appalled. And she went on that trip. I kid you not, she was out of the house probably about 5 minutes, and I was by myself. And I didn't even think about it. I just got up like a reaction. And I went to her closet, and I found her lockbox where it had money and pills and some other things. And I sold them. And it only took me a few days, but I kept going back to that box and going, okay, this is the last time. Like, I'm just going to take a little bit more, you know. And I remember at one point when I took the last of what was in there, money and everything, I remember something in my head told me, what are you doing? Stop, you know. And I remember very clearly to this day saying, shut up. I'll do whatever I want. And so I did. My mom returned back home, and I was in the middle of getting ready to go out and probably not come home for a week or whatever I did. And she came into the door, you know, my bedroom door, and she said, hey. And she just had tears, you know. I hope I never forget the look on her face, you know, because the look on her face some days is the number one thing that keeps me sober. And it was a look of a lot of things, okay? It was a look of complete and utter disappointment. Disappointment in me, disappointment in her parenting. She thought it was her fault. Anger. She was really, really mad. But most of all, I saw in her just an absolute disgust for what she saw standing in front of her. Because I wasn't her daughter anymore. She was like, who are you, you know? She said, I told you if you stole from me, you were out. You have 10 minutes. Get your stuff. Get out. You know, get everything you need to get, but you're not staying here, and you're out. You're out, you know. And I just remember blubbering and crying and yelling and saying, how could you do this to me? I'm your daughter, you know. See, I always had a way that I could turn it around so that people, I would turn it around so people would be, it would be their fault, because it couldn't be my fault. All I'm doing is drinking and having a good time. You're the problem. You know, my drinking's not the problem. But you have a problem with drinking. No, I don't. You have a problem with telling me that I have a problem. I mean, really. And this is the way I thought. And what a change. But, you know, I got everything I could together, and I got out in my car, and I huffed and I puffed and I cried, and, you know, and everything else, and made this huge big deal. The neighbors were coming out, you know, very embarrassing. And sorry, guys. And so what happened was, is I was real, real tough, okay? And so we lived in like a brand new home division, you know, of houses. And so I was like, man, I'm going to show her. I'm going to sleep in my car. It's going to be the best place ever. I'm going to make it all like in a little apartment. I had a Geo Prism. It wasn't going to be that big of an apartment. But what I did, okay, is I drove like maybe two blocks, maybe like two and a half blocks. And I noticed that the crash had just happened. This was in 2010, okay? The crash had happened in 2008, end of 2008, going into 2009. And the economy busted. Of course, all the builders stopped building. But they had gotten pretty far on these houses. So there was driveway, and there was like frame up. So I just pulled into a driveway. And I was like, yeah, see? I'm tough. I could see my mom's chimney from where my car was parked. Man. And I sat there and I drank, you know, and I did that for a while, you know, because I still didn't see that I had a problem. I had no problem, you know, it was everybody else's problem. And so, you know, my drinking took me to places that I did things I never thought I would do. I stole from my family, but I also stole from stores. I stole from stores. I stole alcohol from stores, or I sold things so that I could go back in the return line of Walmart and then do the whole receipt thing and then get money, and then I would get more alcohol. And I did this for a while, and one night, sleeping in my car, my mom called me, and she said, hey, your stepdad and I, we're going to let you come home, okay? We're going to let you come home. We're going to give you dinner, and we're going to let you shower, you know, and then you got to go. And so that's what I did. You know, I was so excited. So I drove the 2.5 blocks back, you know. Got out, and she's standing at the door, and she goes, where were you at? I said, oh, man, I'm just staying, like, right around there up on so-and-so street. And she was so mad at me. She said, Candace, do you know how long of the nights that I've spent how many nights I've spent up and awake, not knowing if you're murdered, maimed, raped, dead, sliced into little pieces on the side of Highway 50, and you've been 2.5 blocks away. Another part of me, another point where I should have inside of me said, you know what, I might have a problem, ignored it, said, shut up, walked in and got my dinner. You know, that's right, you need to have me over for dinner. I'm your daughter. Don't you feel bad for me? I'm sleeping in my car. And so we had Jack in the Box. It was awesome. And then at the end of it, I was almost done eating, and she said, Candace, I don't know exactly what is your problem, but you obviously have something going on. You're not yourself. And we want you to go get help. Now, my mom's an addict, okay? My stepdad, full-blown alcoholic, okay? At that time, and they still are. And I share that because at this point in the conversation, all they could do was look at me and look at each other, crying, and look at me and just go, this is the best we can come up with. And they said to me, tomorrow morning we want you to get up, and we want you to go to the hospital in Reno, and we want you to tell them that you need help. And I remember looking at her and saying, everything that I've done to you and to myself, I was tore up from the floor up. I wish I had pictures from that time. But I said, I'd rather die than do anything else right now. I just want to die. I just want to go away. I don't want to have to deal with anything. And at that point, she said, then you need to go in and you need to walk into that ER and you need to tell them that you want to take your own life. And maybe that'll get you help, you know. And I looked at her and I lied to her just one more time, you know, and I said, okay, Mom, I will. Slept that night there, got up, and I was like, okay. She goes, okay, so you're going to go. I said, yeah, Mom, I'm going to go. It's going to be great. I'll call you later, you know. And I don't really know how many days went by, but I did go into Reno because we lived in the outskirts of Reno. I did go into town. I shoplifted some more. I sold some more alcohol, and then I was almost done with the 3 bottles that I had gotten of some Sailor Jerry and doing some other substances, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. I wasn't drunk, and I wasn't high. I literally was awake and fine, and like I could see straight, and I could feel everything, and nothing was working, and no substances I was putting in my body anymore were working, and it scared out of me. And at that point, I drove over to the emergency room, and I parked in the parking lot, and I slowly got out of my car, and I walked into the emergency room, and it was like my physical body walking in there, if you get this, but something else was walking me in that emergency room. And I was fighting it the whole way up in my head, you know. I was like, what are you doing, you know? Get back in the car, you know. The party's not over, you're fine, you know. But my legs kept moving, and my body kept walking towards that emergency room door, and I did. I went in there, it was like 3-something in the morning. And the young lady behind the counter, you know, she was really nice. There was nobody else in there. Another God moment. There was nobody else in there. It's Reno on like a Friday night, and there's nobody in the emergency room at 3:30 in the morning. I thought that was kind of weird. And she said, you know, how can I help you? And I said, I want to die. And I was wondering if you could help me, because if I don't get any help, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I voluntarily 5150 myself and put myself in the hospital. And best thing I ever did. Best thing he ever did. And so from there, you know, what happened for me was I had to do a pretty good couple weeks in a mental institution. And in there I had a spiritual awakening, you know. I had my first big spiritual moment of clarity where it was like my higher power just had a seat on the bed next to me, you know. And he was like, you done? It's just very clear to me. He was like, are you done? And I cried, and I remember for the first time in a long time, like I actually cried, you know, like it came out of me. Because all the other times I was crying so that they would feel sorry for me and give me something for free, drugs or alcohol. And this time I was literally crying, and I just had a moment where I was done. And from there, you know, things really started to happen. You know, I told those doctors in there when they called me back in like they did every day and said, you know, do you still want to die? Do you still want to harm yourself? And I looked at that doctor and I said, no, I want to live and I have a problem with drugs and alcohol, and I can't go on like this anymore, and I need help, you know? And she was like, what? And I had to say it again for her so she would hear me. And I said, no, I really want to live, you know? I don't want to die anymore. I just want to live, but I can't live if I keep doing what I'm doing. And I got out of there, you know, and I had to live on the streets for a while. And I met some really cool people there. I'm still in contact with a few of them that went into rehab off the streets when I went into rehab. And, you know, I was able to survive. You know, I was able to stay sober for about 3 weeks on the streets out there. And that was God. That was the God of my understanding for sure. Because let me tell you, there was no shortage of it going on around me. And, you know, people would, I had a tough choice, you know, because people would give me a place to, like, stay with them on their tent or on their sleeping bags and stuff, but they were drinking and they were using, and I was like, yeah, it's October or end of September in Reno. It's 12 degrees. Yeah, whatever. Just ignore what they're doing and just, you know, go to sleep. And I did. And throughout this whole time, you know, my higher power was right next to me. You know, I people offered it to me. I was like, no, you know, you sure you don't want to drink? Come on, you know, we're homeless, whatever. You know, I was like, no, you know, something kept telling me, no, I'm done with that. No, I'm done. You know, and I think I remembered what I said in that mental institution, you know, when I had that conversation with my higher power, and that higher power kept asking me, are you done? And I was like, yeah. And I was really done. And so my dad, I called my dad, and my dad, he was shocked. He had no idea that I had any problems. He was here in Fresno. And he got me into a wonderful, long-term inpatient program in Fresno. And you might have heard of it, Salvation Army. And I got in that program, and from the moment I got in there, they told me all the rules, and I was all, yeah, whatever. I don't care. I don't care what your rules are, because I'll do all of them. And I did, and I got to have a big sister in that program that, like, helped me out, show me the ropes, and then I got to be a big sister in that program. And that program was only 6 months long, but I stayed for a year because I needed to. And also because, let's be real, I came in homeless, so I didn't have anywhere to go. And that program, you know, they let me stay there. And they introduced me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they took me to my first meeting in a big white bus with a whole bunch of other girls. And we were all dressed like guys because we were in a program with men and women, and you couldn't look at the men and you couldn't wear anything. Okay, so you get the idea. So I had on like a size 4X shirt, collared shirt, you know, and khakis. And I went to my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that meeting is now to this day my home group of the Village Group in Fresno. Okay. And the first meeting I walked into, the number one thing I heard was laughter. And it shocked me. I couldn't believe, like, what are these people so happy about, you know? And they were really, really happy. And one of the ladies that ended up being my grand sponsor, she came up to me and gave me this big old hug. And I was like, I didn't know what to do. I just came from being on the streets. You don't hug people. That's like up here. This is why I can hug you guys, because I'm not living that life anymore. I can hug people today, and I can, like, really mean it, you know, and I meant every one of those hugs up there. I'm so proud of all you guys coming up. And I went through that program, and I got a sponsor, and I took the suggestions, even though I thought they were stupid or silly or they weren't going to work. What are these people talking about? I was like, whatever, I'll do it anyways, you know. What do I got to lose? I'm in a house with 19 other women. I'm not going anywhere for a while. Might as well take the suggestions. Might as well read the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, whatever. And then I start reading it, and I go, oh, wow. And I hear in there, like, my story, when I read Bill's story, me and Bill would have hung out really well. Bill drank like I did. You know, he was like, no, 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 it'll be different this time. He kept doing that, right? And being able to read through that book and then read it through line by line with the sponsor helped me very much. because I read it one way, and then when we read it together, it was like, oh, you know, I got a big book dictionary because I need that. I wasn't alive in 1935 and 36 and 37, so yeah, I needed a dictionary to help me. I don't know if any of you can relate. And I needed to know what the heck they were talking about in there on some of those words. And what it's like for me today is ever since coming into the doors of that rehab and going to my first meeting of AA, I had to do a lot of stuff. I had to listen to other people that had more time than me. I had to give my phone number once I got a phone back, which took a long time. I had to give my phone number to women. Now today I get to do that. But I had to really get out of my comfort zone of what I thought was comfortable for me, because what I think is comfortable for me at that time, what was comfortable for me was putting as much booze and drugs as I could in my system so I didn't have to, so I could just check out, you know? And that wasn't an option anymore, because I saw what that option did. That option got me homeless, carless, and in 5150 mode. So I couldn't do that anymore. And so what I did is I just followed people's feet. And if they went to a meeting, I went to a meeting. If they met with their sponsor, I was like, oh, let me call my sponsor, you know, on the payphone at the rehab. I did the things that I needed to do to be able to let my higher power take that obsession from my mind, you know, because it was always talking. And when I was able to do my third step with a sponsor, and we said that third step prayer together in front of a Catholic church at like 8:30 at night after a meeting, I remember, and I got down on my knees, and she got down on her knees. And we said that third step prayer, and something changed. And that's when recovery really took off for me, you know. It wasn't just about, you know, making my mind shut up anymore and just doing what everybody did and just being a robot. Something changed in the fact that I really wanted this, you know. I wanted to stay sober. I didn't want to have to put something in to get anything to come out. I wanted to be able to find a better solution than the way that I was doing it before. For a long time, it took me a long time to do my steps. I really procrastinated a lot on the fourth step. I didn't want to do it because I didn't want to look at like that stuff. I had buried that stuff under a lot of drinks, okay? And I didn't want to like dig it back up again. But you know, my sponsor really helped me in that. She told me to hold this rock. She's Native American, okay? And so she had like lots of rocks and really cool stuff, you know? And I was at her apartment one day and she had this rock and it was real jagged, like real sharp on one side, and then it was real smooth on the other. And she had me hold that rock, you know? And she said, I want you to squeeze it really tight. And when it starts to hurt your hand, I want you to tell me, okay? And I go, okay. And so we were reading through some step writing I had been doing, and about 10 minutes into it, she's like, how's your hand? You know, is it hurting? I go, it hurts, but it's cool. I got it. You know, it's fine. You know, it's shaking. And she goes, oh, okay. You know, about 10 minutes later, so she's like, hey, how's your hand? Is it hurting? I see. Yeah. And she's like, your knuckles are white, you know, and your hand's shaking. I'm like, yeah, it hurts. She's all, and I'm not going to say a bad word, but she said some expletives. She said, drop rock, Candace. You know, and at that moment, you know, she explained to me that I had been carrying around all this hurt and pain and guilt and shame and anger and, you know, all these different feelings. And she's like, you don't have to do that anymore. Do you understand that? You don't have to do that anymore. If you're willing to do this fourth step, to go back to the rehab and go right out your fourth step, you don't have to hold on to that pain anymore. Like you were holding on to that rock and it was cutting your hand and your hand was shaking. You don't have to do that anymore. And at that moment, like, it just made it really simple. So I went back to the rehab and I wrote the whole fourth step. I was up past lights out and, you know, I thought I was going to get busted. And I wrote out that fourth step and I couldn't wait to read it to her. You know, when we made an appointment and I did my fifth step with her. And after that, things became a lot easier, you know, because I wasn't fighting it anymore. I wasn't like, no, I'll do it later. You know, I'll put it off. You know, I just did the work. I just did the work. One thing that helped me is I went to a lot of meetings, you know, and if I did have the opportunity to get called on, I shared about how I was having a hard time on this step I was on. Man, I just put it out there. And then every share after that would be like, well, I get what you're saying. I'm having problems with that, but this is how I did that. You know, they talked about how they found the solution. You know, what did they do? You know, and it helped. It really helped. And so today, you know, whenever I'm asked to be of service in any way in Alcoholics Anonymous, no matter what inside my head says, there's like, no, you have so much stuff to do. I work two jobs. I mean, come on. You're sponsoring five women. What are you thinking? You know, but out of my mouth is my higher power. Thank God he's got control, because he says, yeah, I'll do that. I'd be honored to do that, you know. And so you know, getting to come and share my story. And I've been to this meeting numerous times, and getting to come hear other speakers that are up here talking has helped me immensely, you know, because I get to hear how they work their program, and I get to hear, plain and simple, how have you not drank for X amount of years? You know, how have you done that? Tell me, because I want to know. Because, you know, we all have a different way of working this program, but the solution is in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm actually going through the book again with the sponsee. We're reading it line by line. And I think it was Grace that read chapter 7, and I just read that two nights ago on my sobriety birthday. Actually, I stayed up, and I just couldn't sleep, and I was really excited, you know. And I was like, if I don't drink till midnight, I'm going to make it, you know. I was so excited, and so sometimes I get so excited I can't sleep, and so I read it. You know, I read those pages, and I took another suggestion from my sponsor. She's like, read these pages, you know, 83 through 89, you know, just read them. And today, you know, I get the opportunity, both ways. I get the opportunity at the place where I work. I'm the only person who can't drink alcohol at my work. Everybody else, all normies. And I work with, like, I don't know, in the office alone, over 60 people. And so on Fridays, you know, I have my routine, and let me tell you, they have theirs. And I get the opportunity to know that when I get off work on Fridays, I get to go home and eat dinner, and then I'm going to my home group, and I'm going to go to a meeting. And that's awesome to me, because I get to go to a place where there's not alcohol being served and passed around. Like, I get to go to my safe area, my safe place, my safe people, people who are like me. And what they do is they make their routine, too. And they have little mini fridges in their office, all the managers, and they crack open their beers and their wine and their liquor. And my boss likes scotch. And I tell them, hey, have a great weekend. They're all, you too, Candace. And then when I leave and shut the door, I can hear it get real loud in there, because now they know they can really let go. Now they're like, she's gone, you know. The sober one's gone, you know. No, but they, you know, they, all of them know my story. They all know about me, you know, and that's just how my story is. That's my experience, that I've been able to share that with my employer and my coworkers for almost 4 years now. And they're like nothing but respectful of my sobriety and wholeheartedly give me a big pat on the back. Good job, you know. And I'm like, all I did was take direction. That's all. Good orderly direction, you know. Whatever you want to call that higher power, that's what it is for me. And you know, I also get to have days like today where my mom was having a meltdown, and she was real upset over something that's going on with her living situation. And I said, Mom, do you think you should take, you know, your prescription? And she's like, what? And she's crying. I can barely understand her. And I said, you have a prescription from your doctor for Valium. You know, do you think you should take one? She goes, I didn't even think of that. And I go, yeah, but I did. And that's why, you guys, I have to come to meetings, okay? Because, see, my first thought is still, after 8 years, is if you don't feel good, well, just change the way you feel. Just take something and change the way you feel. And I was talking to her about it on my way here. I had her on Bluetooth. And she goes, I think you should share that at the meeting. I said, I will. I am very much in acceptance of the fact that I'm an alcoholic through and through. I'm a true alcoholic. And my alcoholism manifests in a lots of different ways, in lots of areas of my life, and a lot of relationships, you know. And my first thought is still, you know, you don't, if you're all stressed out, you're crying and stuff, just take a Valium, just take a Xanax. Like, that's where my mind goes. So I've got to stay in service. I've got to stay being part of, there's a great convention coming this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I got to be part of that. I've been part of it since March, you know. I got to be in a group of alcoholics who are all going the same direction. Because I get too far from that group of people, I'm in real, real trouble. Because at that point, my thinking takes over, my higher power, I can't hear him anymore. I can't hear that. All I hear is the easier, softer way, which I think is, you know. And so tonight, when I say that I'm so very grateful to be here, I mean it with all my heart. And I mean it with every ounce of my frickin' sobriety. I'm really glad to be here. And I can't believe how many people are here. Thank you for listening and being so nice to have me. Have a great night.